Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 8 of NML Crossing, the show that is destined to be Did You Mean on Google for ever and ever and ever. You know, with the name, NML Crossing, I thought I was being clever, which is usually and generally speaking my first and greatest mistake each and every time that I think I have a clever idea, but it's catchy, I like it, so I guess we'll keep it. Now today, we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about a Red Sky crossover. I don't know if I have to explain what a Red Sky crossover is. I feel like that's one of those things in comics that we, you know, enlightened podcasters like to, purport to know about and lecture on. Things like the DC implosion. We like to talk about that because it makes it feel like we're dealing with a science of sorts. And Red Sky crossovers is kind of, I put that in the same sort of bucket, I guess. But we'll get into, you know, the what's and whys and whatever the hells of a Red Sky crossover on the other end. But first, I want to kind of continue a discussion or a ramble that I had last episode. We were talking about Catwoman, and I had asked the open question, what do we consider the first ongoing of a character? Do we consider that volume one, or if that volume was preceded by a miniseries or multiple miniseries, do we mark them as, you know, subsequent volumes accordingly? So last episode, it was Catwoman. I didn't know if it was Catwoman or Catwoman Volume 2 because there was a miniseries that preceded it, you know, several years prior. Today, and I threatened this when we discussed that one, that we have a kind of a sticky wicket as it pertains to volumes in today's episode. This is Robin number 52, and a little bit of insight into my messed up mind and the silly stuff that I stress over and that keeps me awake at night. We're talking about Robin. And, well, what volume do we label this as? This is a little bit stickier than Catwoman because this is Robin's first ongoing. So do we call it Volume 1? Or, since there was a miniseries called Robin a few years before this, do we call it Volume 2? Or, here's the added bit here. Do we call it Volume 4? Since there were three Robin miniseries before the ongoing launched. Though, those were called Robin 2 and Robin 3. The first Robin miniseries wasn't called Robin 1. So, would we call Robin 2, Robin 2 Volume 1? Or Robin 3 Volume 1? Or do we count them as actual volumes? I mean, I'm tugging at a string that really doesn't need tugging on here, but I have a problem pushing past this kind of thing here. I guess for the purposes of the show, we will call it Robin Volume 2, or I'll just say Robin. I'll say it interchangeably, and I'm sure I'll flip-flop on this during the project, and I'm sure with every flip-flop, I will regret whatever the decision I'm currently on. We do have a piece of mail toward the end of the episode, which might give us our best, you know, get out of volume purgatory card yet here. Our friend Ed Moore had he opined with how he marks or denotes the volumes, and we'll get to that on the other end here. But I don't know. I do want to open up the question to anybody who's still listening to me spit nonsense into this microphone here, what would you call this? Would you call this Robin Volume 2? Would it be Robin? I can't say words. There's a reason why I can't say words. But I don't want to talk about it. Well, maybe we'll talk about it another time. I'm having trouble with words. We will maybe discuss that another time. Let's get into it. Let's just hop on in. This is a weird one. It is Robin, volume, whatever the hell you want to call it, number 52, April 1998 cover date. The story is called Cataclysm, Volume 7, Tribunal, written by Chuck Dixon, with art by Staz Johnson and Stan Wach. Colors, Adrian Roy. Letters, Tim Harkins. Edits, Gore Finkel and O'Neill. Cover price, $1.95. Our story opens, well, not in Gotham City, but in Krasnovolny, or as the DC Wikia calls it, Krasnivolna. In fairness, the DC Wiki also says that this place first appeared 2 years after this issue that we're looking at, in Birds of Prey number 18, June 2000 cover date, so who knows? Maybe, I can't even, who knows? Now, it's apparently a very Dixon-y region of Transbelvia, which is seeking independence from the Belvians or something. I don't know that that really matters for the purposes of our story or our visit here, so we will just push on. Anyway, we've got the, well, very Dixon-y character King Snake arriving on the scene, surrounded by dudes who look like, they kind of look like G.I. Joe's October Guard. Like, they got the big hats, the stars on them and stuff. Now, they've descended on Robin and a girl named Deva, who who are stood over the dead body of Lady Shiva, or Shiva. This is why I need to stick to print. Worth noting that Dava, is dressed kind of like, you know how Jubilee's costume was kind of based on Robin's? It's kind of like that. So she's kind of Robin-y, kind of Jubilee-y, but she has like a paint on her eye. Anyway, we find out here that last issue, Robin was poisoned with a drug called Aramilla, or Aramia. It was passed to him via a kiss from Dava, and this drug gave him the power, speed, and ability to kill Lady Shiva with his bare hands. Now Robin's freaking out. He attempts to revive Shiva and asks Deva to provide him some cover, and so she leaps into action, beat first. Now you see, she's also infected with the Aramilla stuff and is exhibiting the powers not unlike those of a speedster, like she's just zipping around. Robin performs the standard mouth-to-mouth that all fictional characters immediately go to in times like these. And we get like 5 pages of this. You know, Robin alternating between mouth-to-mouth and chest compressions intermixed with scenes of Deva kicking Balny butt. Or is it Krasny butt? It doesn't matter. From here, we hop outside to General... Tavorakovic? Who, along with an aide called Savanov, are killed in a car bomb explosion. Now, coming in cold like we are, we haven't the foggiest idea who these guys are, what their deals are, or what they're here for. But whatever the case, they go boom and... Oof, I mean, this really doesn't make for the greatest, you know, in-event crossover tie-in fodder, does it? Anyway, some October Guard-looking guys witness this happen and talk about flipping over to Dava's side in, I guess it's a revolution? Maybe I'm just really, really dense. I don't know. Back inside, Robin finally manages to revive Lady Shiva. The thing of it is, you know, he did that whole mouth-to-mouth gimmick, and he still has that Aramia stuff in his system, and I guess in his breath and lips and whatnot. And, well, since it was passed to him via a kiss... you could probably see where this is headed, right? So before we know it, Shiva springs back up to her feet with a feeling as though her blood is literally on fire. Just then, Dava is shot in the friggin' head. Like, literally, shot in the head. No worries, though, because she isn't dead, she's just stunned. Like, she is shot, like, right above the eye. Shot in the head. I don't know. I'd ask questions, but we have no time for that, because Shiva is zipping around the shack just taking care of business. She is tossing and killing dudes left and right. Robin uses this distraction in order to drag Dava away to relative safety, with, of course, you know, that big gaping hole in her skull. Now, as Shiva is about to pounce on King Snake, the baddie, the other baddie, proclaims that he will never die on a ballroom floor. Which is a line I'd love to add to my own personal vernacular. Maybe even make them my own dying words, which would, at the very least, make people ask questions after the fact, wouldn't it? Anyway, outside, we rejoin Robin, who is still carrying Daba. He hears the gunfire go nuts, and then everything goes silent. At this point, he doesn't even care who won or lost. And after putting Daba down, he collapses into the snow himself. Now, he notes that the gaping hole in Dava's skull has frozen and the bleeding has stopped, which I suppose is convenient enough. And I gotta say, this did not look like a glancing blow. You know, this was like a full-on shot to the head. Just then, our hero finds himself surrounded by maybe those October Guard guys who witnessed the car bomb explosion a few pages back? I'm thinking it was them. Whatever the case, he's looking down the business end of several machine guns. He dares them to shoot. Like, not in a badass sort of way. More of like a, you know what, guys, I'm too tired for this crap. Just shoot me and get it over with. You know, it's much more a resignation rather than a, you know, go ahead, make my day sort of thing. Daba gets up, and she's disappointed that General Tvorakovic got away. One of the October Guard, a dude named Tibor, he informs her that that wasn't the case at all, and he shows her something to prove it. Like, it's like a brown mass. It might be the general's head. It might be a toupee. It might be a lump of sod. I really can't tell what it is. Whatever it is, though, Daba is pleased to be looking at it and knows that their mission's been accomplished. Was it the general's pelt? I really don't know. Anyway, Robin begins throwing a tantrum here. And he says that one death isn't going to fix anything. It's just going to make the other side come back and kill two of theirs. The whole violence begets violence, vengeance begets vengeance, all that kind of stuff. And he starts, like, really laying into the October Guard guys here. He's like, you guys call yourself soldiers, but back in Gotham City, you'd be little more than gangsters. Speaking of Gotham City, wasn't, like, a very bad thing happening there that we're supposed to be getting to? And maybe we'll get there later. Daba suggests that Tim settle his tea kettle here, because he knows not what which he speaks, however that saying goes, but again, I can't say words. She pretty much calls him an entitled American brat before telling him to F off into the night. And so Robin decides, it's probably time to go home. While on the Gotham-bound plane, he calls his father to let him know he's on his way. During the chat, Tim tells his dad that he doesn't want there to be any secrets between them, and that when he gets home, they gotta have a long talk. You know, that talk. Well, most of that talk. He'll likely come out as Robin, but won't spill any of the other Bat family beans. Tim returns to his seat just in time for the pilot to come over the PA system, informing the passengers that, well, due to some cataclysmic sort of stuff, they're being rerouted to land in Bloodhaven. And we close out with Tim peeping out the window and seeing the smoldering ruins of Gotham City. Red Sky crossover, friends. That's where we leave it. Next time, it's our first one-shot, Blackgate, Isle of Men, #1. Now, before we hop into my bulletproof, hard-hitting analysis of this issue, let's take a look at the Watch This Space column that often appears in DC Comics of the Day. It's not always going to have anything to do with anything we're covering. And today it really doesn't either, but maybe it'll turn out to later, I don't know. Not much bad stuff in this column, except the fact that Steve Ditko recently popped into the DC offices for a visit, and that Denny O'Neil, the, you know, bigwig of the Bat books, hopes to get him on some sort of Bat project in the near future. Could you imagine? I mean, we all like Ditko, right? Or at the very least, we respect Ditko. But, turn of the century Ditko on a Bat project? I don't know. And hell, I mean, for all I know, this did come to pass. Maybe, like, a few months down the line, we'll be looking at some No Man's Land issues of Shadow of the Bat or Legends of the Dark Knight or the, you know, anthology Batman Chronicles, and it'll have Ditko art? Maybe? Who knows? Probably not. But I figured I'd mention it. Maybe this is a little snippet that will pay off somewhere down the line. Okay, into talking time. We're going to talk about this issue, and, you know, I haven't checked the Cataclysm is it an omnibus or whatever the hell they're calling the latest, most complete collected version of the story. But in my turn of the century Cataclysm trade, this story is left out. And I mean, it probably should have. I mean, it definitely should have been. This was truly an odd choice for a tie-in. Going back to that From the Den essay we looked at back in episode 1, Detective 719, this particular chapter, if we can even call it that, kind of flies in the face of a lot of what Denny said there. I mean, 90, being very conservative here, 90% of this issue had zero to do with Cataclysm. But it's got that big old Cataclysm branding running down the left-hand side of the cover. It looks like, if you just look at the cover, it looks like Robin is coming back to witness the destruction of Gotham, which, fair play, that happened. But the way that it's depicted in the on the cover, and I get covers not necessarily evoking what happens inside, but I don't know, I had a very different idea about this going in. Now, people who may not be reading Robin, but still wanted to follow this event, would naturally pick this up. And what they'd wind up with is like a conclusion, like a part 3 or a part 4 or a part whatever the hell of a Robin story that you know nothing about. Conversely, if you were a Robin fan who was still, you know, a crossover burnt out and wanted to stay far, far away from Cataclysm, and, you know, of course you weren't a completionist lunatic like me, you might have left this one on the rack. You know, you were following your, you know, your kung fu, martial arts, war-torn, whatever the hell story. You see that we're tying into Cataclysm, and you figure, okay, I'll come back next month. Or the month after that, or maybe never again. Who knows? Now, I think while Azrael was a weak chapter of Cataclysm, this one was an actual misstep. Keeping in mind that that's not an indictment on the issue or the story, quality-wise, just it's a tie-in ability with the greater crossover event. So with that said, how about we do discuss the story a little bit? Well, Chuck Dixon certainly likes his martial arts stories, doesn't he? And again, fair play to him, and, you know, those folks who also enjoy them. Unfortunately, and again, no indictment on quality, I'm just not one of those folks. I've tried the Richard Dragon Kung Fu Fighters, the Iron Fists, the Shang-Chi's, you know, all those characters kind of rooted in, like, the 70s Kung Fu genre. And I just don't have any affinity for any of them. Add to that the fact that we're opening this issue on a cliffhanger without much in the way of context. I mean, we're just kind of left to figure things out. And, I mean, if you're buying this for Cataclysm, that's not what you signed up for. Like, you'd ask yourself, who is this girl who's kind of dressed like Robin? Kind of looks like Jubilee? I don't know. Why is the country they're in such a state? And why doesn't What's-His-Face with the blonde ponytail want to die on a ballroom floor? You know, if you were reading Robin, I'm sure most of these things made perfect sense. Though maybe not the ballroom floor thing. But, I mean, if you were following Robin, you'd be able to enjoy this as just the next issue of the book that you follow, right? Unfortunately, and again, not any fault of the book itself, that's not what we, or at least I, am here for today. And no bones about it, I say that somewhat selfishly, because I'm sure somewhere down the line, when there's more episodes of this than people can, like, easily hop onto and catch up with, I'll probably start collecting these episodes like I did with X-Lapsed and other projects that we've done here on the channel. And, like, going from chapter 6 to chapter 7 to chapter 8 of Cataclysm is going to be very weird, because we're going to have this last part of a, you know, war-torn kung fu story here, and I don't know. Now, it might be worth noting that a few months after this, Dixon would go on to helm another, like, mini-crossover, Brotherhood of the Fist, I think it's called. And it sounds pretty martial artsy. And it crosses through Detective Comics, Green Arrow, Nightwing, and I think Robin. Thankfully, it does not have the Cataclysm nor Aftershock branding on it. And so we could pretend it never happened. And, you know, I'd be surprised if there was zero mention of Gotham City having been destroyed during that story. But we're going to skip it all the same. overall, I feel like I'm being so unfair toward this book, since it's very much a Red Sky crossover. And I mean, when Tim's flying over Gotham, it's literally Red Skied, you know? But I mean, if you were reading Robin, and you dig Dixon's martial arts stories, you'd probably like this a lot, as it does pay off a story that had been going on for a bit, and it finds a way to organically get Tim onto our cataclysmic chessboard. I will say, I do wish we got a little bit more, I don't know if context is the right word, but more on the discussion between Tim and his dad. I mean, we don't need much context, so that's probably the wrong word to use, as it's pretty obvious where this was supposed to be headed before the very bad thing happened. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. You'd figure, I mean, one ought to have assumed that this might be some people's first issue of Robin. I mean, we're long past the every issue is somebody's first issue. It's the late 90s. That ship sailed. But this is a crossover, you know? So this may have been people's first issue of Robin. Or at the very least, the first issue of Robin that they'd read in a very long time. So maybe there could have been a little bit more to that phone call. Maybe some more internal dialogue. I don't know. Anyway, you know, not much more to say about this one. As an issue, it's okay. As a Cataclysm tie-in, maybe a little less okay. And if you still want to know what a Red Sky crossover is, I'll try to make it as brief as possible, because I'm sure most people know. It's a reference to issues that crossed, or technically crossed over during Crisis on Infinite Earths. Those books that couldn't play ball, or just plain wouldn't play ball with the crossover, were relegated to having the skies turned red in the panels, in the artwork, to suggest that, yes, in fact, Crisis is going on during this story. You know, it doesn't cross over with the story necessarily, doesn't play ball with it, doesn't play the cards where they lie, and all those, you know, other cliches, but the skies were red, so they were happening concurrently with the actual play ball crossovers. All right, from here, let's hop into the mailbag, or as I have it in my notes, the NML bag, which, if you say that quickly, sounds kind of disgusting, so I will try not to call it that anymore. We will start with a missive from our friend CJ Standall regarding Asriel number 40. This is over at the blog crisisoninfiniteearths.com. He says, I too am surprised that Asriel lasted as long as it did. For all my collecting of the Bat Family titles in the 90s, I only had one Asriel comic and a few others in trade paperback form, like the Contagion trade paperback. And yeah, Asriel was one of those books that when I made my leap across the new release table from Marvel to DC, or Marvel and DC, I guess, at the time, I never picked up Asriel. I never had any kind of interest or desire or curiosity about Asriel. I want to say the first issue I picked up was a tie-in for sure. And you'll have to forgive me, my timelines are a little weird now. I think it really depends on which of these stories came first. It was either the Joker Last Laugh tie-in or the Bruce Wayne Fugitive tie-in. I think it was Joker Last Laugh that came first, though I could be mistaken. But that was like, those were like the only issues of Asriel I owned. I eventually came into, you know, a cluster of them in quarter and 50 cent bins, just grabbed them for no reason at all. But when I realized that, you know, this thing went 100 issues, that's very, very bizarre. Back to CJ, he says, I do like his costume, although it's definitely 90s excess and would be frustrating for an artist to have to continually draw. But I didn't really like his character much. The best parts of his character seemed to be, like in this issue, based on your synopsis, the parts that were tied into his promotion and benching from Batman. His attempts to escape his religious upbringing were also somewhat interesting, but not enough for a 100-ish issue series, in my opinion. Maybe I'll give this a read if I find it in the wild for cheap, or if I have some time to read it on DC Universe Infinite, which he says is a name he often forgets despite using it on a weekly basis. So the DC Unlimited is actually DC Universe Infinite, which I'm sure I will forget most times I bring it up again in the future. But we are in full agreement there, my friend. Asriel's most interesting parts are the fact that he, you know, he arrived on the scene, he became friggin' Batman, and then was pushed to the side. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. You know, no matter the era, no matter... Well, maybe this era would be different since, like, characters trade costumes like, you know, like friendship bracelets nowadays. It's, back in the day, it was, you know, that was a big deal. It was a big deal for so many reasons. It's like the natural chain of succession for Batman would be like, okay, well, Dick Grayson will be Batman. But instead, it's this weirdo Jean-Paul Valley, or Ballet. I don't know how you say his name, but it was very weird. And I remember being on the, you know, the peripheral, you know, when Nightfall and Night Quest was happening. And although I had no dog in the fight and really no interest in most things DC at the time, I still felt like it was a slap in the face to Dick Grayson to be passed over for this crazy weirdo that we never met before, or we, you know, only knew briefly. That said, I kind of wish Denny played a little bit more with maybe some internal conflict when Bane makes him this offer. You know, that they are one and the same. They have... And I mean, I think a lot of us conflate them, not so much confuse them, but kind of squish them together because they both arrived on the scene around the same time. They all kind of peaked during the same story, and they were kind of like natural yin and yang of that Nightfall era. But I think it would have been cool for Azrael to maybe consider Bane's offer, you know, because despite the fact that Azrael's kind of an asshole, he was, you know, he was promoted and benched, as CJ put it here. That's, he was treated unfairly. You know, he wasn't properly vetted. So he really wasn't doing anything wrong. He was just being himself. You know, that's the way he was brought up. That was his training. That was his methodology. He was just doing what he did. It just happened to not align with, you know, the whatever the Bat family does or how they choose to operate. And in the issue that we discussed in episode 5, I think it was, Azrael came across as a guy who's just trying to make right. You know, even if it's not natural or organic, he's just, it's just a make right. And I think that kind of sells the drama a little bit short. I think there should have been more conflict there. And regarding Azrael's costume, the costume is cool. I do like the costume, the original, you know, Quesada design from Sword of Azrael. I think that's really cool. But it's not, it's not long for this world at this point. I want to say Azrael 49 or 50, which we will be covering. They are part of No Man's Land or the Road to No Man's Land, something, one of those. He will change costumes. And he's going to get a... it's like, I want to say it's kind of like the Gambit headsock gimmick that like all the heroes in the early mid 90s had, but Azrael discovered it at the turn of the century. I don't know. It's definitely far less striking than the original, and makes him look like he'd be a feature character in like one of the glut comics of like early 90s Valiant. You know, just like a really sort of generic costume, if I'm remembering right, and I'm pretty sure I am since I just bought a buttload of those books the other day. But thank you so much for following along and reaching out, CJ. I hope you're enjoying the project, and I hope you'll continue to stick with it here. And also thank you for reminding me that the app is DC Universe Infinite, which again, I will probably call DC Unlimited until the end of time. Next up, we have an email from our friend Billy D. He says, "Hey Chris, enjoying your Batman and Family event coverage. Great to have you back. I'm going to try and read some of these books on the app. Wish me luck." Well, thank you so much for the kind words, and thank you for coming back to listen to me. As I think I said this last episode, like I love the welcome back messages because, you know, in my lizard brain, people don't realize if I'm here or not. And for the most part, that is true. But you know, there are some of the good folks out there, the real friends who do miss you when you're gone and are happy when you come back. So I like including those messages here. somewhat selfishly, but also as a like a self-reminder. And I tell you, covering and discussing an old Batman story is a lot less pressure and a lot less frustrating than current year X stuff. It's almost like, I don't know, it takes me back to the early days of Crisis on Infinite Earths, where I'm talking about stuff that may or may not even be in continuity anymore. People have moved on from, nobody has, emotional investment's probably not the right term for it, but there's no real sense of urgency to it, where when you cover something current and ephemeral, there's a lot more pressure to stand out, you know, because when the latest issue of whatever X book comes out, I mean, that sucker's been spoiled at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday morning most of the time. You'll get full synopsises, reviews, videos, scans. It's really hard to stand out, especially when, you know, if the fandom is as clicky as the X book fandom can be. It's really hard to be noticed or kind of register in any way. Not that that's the be-all, end-all, but the 25-year-old story, I don't know, that's kind of right up my alley, at least for right now. But thanks again, Billy. Thank you so much. Finally, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show here. We're going to talk to our buddy Ed, who on Facebook wrote about a question I asked during our Catwoman 56 coverage. Now, Ed says, I track my comics using the year the series started in place of a volume number. So this issue would be Catwoman 1993 number 56 to me. And in my head, I think of miniseries as a volume, so if you went that way, this would be volume 2 in my mind. And you know what? I think Ed mostly solved the problem there. At least when we go back to these, quarter century old stories, right? Because, the passive aggressive joke on the cover of one of the many Squirrel Girl number ones that we got? Like, we got a Squirrel Girl number one, like, in January, and then we got another Squirrel Girl number one, like, in July, because, like, three people bought it. And it was like, only our second number one of the year. So it's like, how would you number that one? It's like Squirrel Girl 2016 and Squirrel Girl 2016. It's, I don't know. Nowadays, I think everything's kind of out the window, which probably partially explains why it always feels like my head's going to explode. But for these stories, I think that's probably the most succinct way of putting it, because you wouldn't be able to really confuse much. Whereas with the numbering system, with the, you know, like, is Catwoman the 4-issue miniseries, is that volume 1? Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. I track my collection in an Excel spreadsheet, which probably shows my age. The apps don't work for me so much, or I don't work with the apps, I guess. So I've got these Excel spreadsheets, and like, I'm constantly changing my mind on how I must just have too much idle time. But I will often change from, you know, Nightwing Mini 1 or Nightwing 1-1 or whichever book had a mini series. And I'm kind of an organizational disaster. If you were to look around my library right now, it would look like, it would look like a building in Gotham City, you know, read this story. There's just stuff everywhere. Toppled piles. It's ridiculous. But at the same time, I'm like so particular about how everything is organized and where everything goes and how everything is marked. It's like I'm a sitting contradiction at this point. But I do want to thank Ed so much for sharing his way of marking or denoting volumes. And of course, I want to keep that question open to everybody here. How do you guys do it? And of course, some of our, you know, older open questions, like, how do you organize? How do you file? Where do you file? What do you do? How does your collection look? Because mine looks like Well, Gotham City after 7:03 p.m. So, if you want to share any of your thoughts on that, any of your thoughts on the issues, any of your thoughts on the stories, anything, please feel free to reach out. I can be found all those different ways. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, 90sXmen on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter. I'm always around, and I'm getting better about replying to people. 2023 and, 2022 were not my finest hours insofar as communication is concerned, so I think we're coming out the other side of that, and things are getting better. So I invite and encourage any sort of missives you want to send my way. But I think that's where we will close things off for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for allowing me into your ears for a half hour today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Knowing what you know just makes it harder to think straight, start.